This week on Louisiana Eats, we take a look at the legacy of the segregated South through stories about the intersections of food, race, and labor over the past century. The late Michael Mizell Nelson shares the history of public transportation during the Jim Crow era.
The public space was being renegotiated every ride, so sometimes there were fist fights, people pushed out of the car. The entire period of Jim Crow was being challenged and resisted on a daily basis by blacks in the city.
Then, John T. Edge tracks the history of Southern food from the Civil Rights era through today.
We think about the South as this bunker of tradition, but if you look clearly, this place has evolved in ways that are crazily dynamic.
We look to the past to understand the present on this week's Louisiana Eats. That's coming up next, but first, the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The White House is under congressional pressure to explain its actions following recent media reports that President Trump did nothing about U.S. intel months ago that Russia appeared to have bounties on the heads of American forces in Afghanistan. Trump maintains he had only just learned of the Russia-Taliban arrangement. Meanwhile, NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the U.S. has been responding to Russia's threat in the region.
Pompeo argues that no one should be surprised that the Russians are, in his words, engaged in Afghanistan in a way that's adverse to the United States. He says that's nothing new.
The president has been consistently aware of the challenges that Russia presents to us. And he is aware of the risk in Afghanistan. It's why we have spent so much time over this past year at the president's direction to reduce risk.
The Trump administration reached a deal with the Taliban earlier this year to set the stage for a U.S. troop withdrawal. The U.S. and Russia also issued a joint statement backing that diplomacy. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
The Transportation Department's Inspector General finds Boeing failed to flag major changes to an automated flight control system before government regulators signed off. Flaws in that system are blamed for two 737 MAX plane crashes off Indonesia and Ethiopia in 2018 and 2019. Hundreds of lives were lost. President Trump is denouncing New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio for plans to paint Black Lives Matter on Fifth Avenue, calling it a symbol of hate. NPR's Aisha Roscoe reports that Trump has been lashing out in recent days against some protesters who have attempted to tear down or deface monuments to Confederate leaders and other historical figures.
President Trump says the plan to paint Black Lives Matter on the street outside of Trump Tower in New York City will denigrate the luxury avenue. Trump accused protesters backing Black Lives Matter of saying a derogatory chant about police officers. He also criticized the city council for voting to cut $1 billion from the police department's budget. He speculated that perhaps the police would somehow stop the painting from happening. Washington, D.C. has painted a similar message and mural on a street near the White House. Black Lives Matter is a decentralized protest movement against police brutality and the discrimination of black people. Aisha Roscoe, NPR News.
The U.S., Canada, and Mexico are now operating under a renegotiated trade deal that took effect today. NPR's Giles Snyder reports on the USMCA pact.
The U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal is going into effect with the global economy shaken by the coronavirus pandemic. Last year, trade among the three was valued at some $1.2 trillion. Now all three countries are in a recession. Mexico, meanwhile, says President López Obrador will meet with President Trump in Washington next week to celebrate the start of the new trade rules.
That's NPR's Giles Snyder reporting. This is NPR News. Small businesses appear to have made a comeback in June. The payroll company ADP says that sector added 937,000 jobs last month. Its private survey also shows more people were hired by restaurants, hotels, and construction companies. In all, ADP says it finds the U.S. economy picked up nearly 2.4 million jobs, a glimmer of hope at a time when public health officials in states are bracing for the possibility of an even tougher phase in this coronavirus pandemic. More than a month after much of the country reopened, even under restrictions, more than 30 states are reporting growing caseloads. With more people flouting guidance on masks and physical distancing, public health experts fear new cases could reach 100,000 a day. A series of new laws take effect in Virginia today. Ben Pavier with member station VPM reports the measures include stricter gun control, higher taxes, and responses to Confederate monuments.
Starting today, Virginia cities can control the fate of their Confederate monuments. Women no longer have to wait 24 hours before an abortion procedure. And gun owners face new restrictions, ranging from red flag laws to universal background checks. All told, Virginia's Democratic governor, Ralph Northam, signed almost 1,300 bills passed by the new Democratic majority in the legislature. Virginia Republicans warn of liberal overreach and higher costs for businesses. Democrats dismiss those claims. They're hoping to replicate their success in Virginia by flipping legislatures in Texas, Arizona, and Michigan. For NPR News, I'm Ben Pavier in Richmond.
I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a program that adjusts insurance rates based on safe driving habits. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
Born on the Bayou, with music from John Fred, Van Broussard, Don Rich, Fats Domino, Rod Bernard, T.K. Hulam.
The Harlem Shuffle!
Lee Kleinpeter with you for an hour of solid Louisiana gold, Saturday afternoon at 3 on KRVS for Born on the Bayou. Join me for an enduring and endearing hour of swamp pop and more this Saturday on KRVS, Born on the Bayou.
Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, a staple of Louisiana kitchens for nearly 40 years. Maker of batters, coatings, boils, tartar sauce, cocktail sauce, and more. Dig into homemade Louisiana flavor. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. As in cities worldwide, the streets of New Orleans have come alive this spring with protests, marches, and rallies for racial justice. The Crescent City has long been a hotbed for activism and played an important role in civil rights era organizing that helped put an end to Jim Crow. This week, we take a look at the legacy of the segregated South through stories about the intersections of food, race, and labor over the past century. We begin with the late historian Michael Mizell Nelson, who spent his career studying the experience of working-class New Orleans. We revisit our streetcar ride with Michael as he shares the history of public transportation during the time of sanctioned segregation. Then, we'll hear from the late Dr. Rudy Lombard, whose mother was a housekeeper at an opulent uptown home in New Orleans. Rudy's childhood experiences played a part in leading him to the 1960 McCrory's lunch counter sit-in on Canal Street, which eventually brought about Lombard versus Louisiana, the 1963 Supreme Court decision ending segregation in dining establishments. Finally, we hear from John T. Edge, director of the Southern Foodways Alliance and the author of the Potlicker Papers. John T. tracks the history of Southern food, delving into the issues of race, class, gender, and ethnicity from the civil rights era through today. We look to the past to understand the present on this week's Louisiana Eats. The late Michael Mizell Nelson was a historian whose research explored the labor and cultural history of the iconic New Orleans streetcar. He first became fascinated with streetcars as a young boy, riding back and forth to school. Michael struck up conversations with his fellow riders, many of them much older than he. This is how he began to collect streetcar stories, which he later recorded in his documentary of the same name. Streetcar Stories relates the history of the riders while raising many social justice issues as well, helping to illuminate the lives of New Orleans' domestic workers and public servants. To bring the history to life, in 2010, Louisiana Eats joined Michael for a ride on the oldest continuously operating streetcar in the world. Our conversation began with Michael explaining who historically rode the streetcar.
Well, at certain points, everybody rode the streetcars. Kids might ride it to school if it wasn't within walking distance. Businessmen would ride downtown. Shoppers would ride downtown. So early in the 20th century, before the automobiles took over, there weren't parking spaces downtown, so people would generally leave their cars at home. Then later on in the 1900s, people started to leave the streetcar, and the cars took over. But students, the elderly, working poor, working class, a lot of domestic servants employed in New Orleans, they generally rode the streetcar.
So I understand that because so many of the household workers rode the streetcar, that affected the price and even the scheduling. How did that work?
Well, of course, there's the morning rush hour and afternoon rush hour. But after that, there would often be a movement of people generally from the downtown neighborhoods. A lot of domestic workers would board the cars. So around mid-morning, they'd be going to work, and then depending on whether or not they ended up cooking meals, they might be returning after the evening rush hour in the early evening.
So how did the domestic workers on the streetcars affect keeping the price so low?
Well, because their salaries obviously were, say, in one period might be $5 per week, but the tag to that was plus car fare. And so, in other words, you had the people who were paying their fares were ones who could afford domestic servants, and many of those people served at one time or another on the board for New Orleans Public Transit. And so, in a sense, this is keeping their own costs low because a large number of riders back and forth were domestic servants.
When you were doing your research, I understand you heard some very compelling stories from domestic workers. Tell me one of those tales.
Well, a number of things would happen. I mean, domestic workers at that time would wear uniforms, so they were a very visible part. Certain times of the day, you could count on seeing numbers, and after the morning rush hour, there'd be sort of a secondary rush, and in mid-morning, you see people moving generally from downtown neighborhoods to work in homes in the uptown area. And then after the evening rush, there was an early evening return of those domestic workers who had actually cooked dinners. So you might find them carrying some food home to their families.
Because that was a typical part of some of their pay.
Right. Part of it was the pay was relatively low. The car fare was covered usually by the employer, but it was the leftovers. So there would be the smell of dinners that had been had recently wafting through the streetcar.
It was common for drivers to make quick stops along the way for a sandwich. You've got a story to tell us about a Mardi Gras Day sandwich.
Right. One of the conductorettes I interviewed had to work a double shift on Mardi Gras Day or during the Mardi Gras season. And it was late at night, and she had pretty much an empty car, but she had two, what she described as society women. And she said, I just was so hungry, I had to stop the car. I ran into Cobb's restaurant and placed an order, got back as quickly as I could, and they were extremely upset with me. They said they were going to report me, and they did, but I just had to get something to eat.
What year did segregation on the streetcars end?
It ended in May 1958.
Could you describe how it was in the days of segregation?
Well, it was sort of a ritual that everyone in the city learned as children, white children and black children. It had started in 1902, and it started with a literal screen. There was a chicken wire screen that was mounted permanently. That led to all sorts of problems. There was an organized boycott of African Americans that lasted for months, and so you often would see whites crowded into the front of the car and emptiness in the back. But gradually, they adjusted this to a small piece of wood that New Orleanians still called a screen. It would read, for colored patrons only. So essentially, everyone boarded from the rear where the conductor was, and whites would walk through the section reserved for blacks and then take a seat in the front. and the ritualistic atmosphere. I mean, it's one thing if you're trying to institute Jim Crow and there's this water fountain is for this race, this is for that one. The public space was being renegotiated every ride. So sometimes there were small disturbances. Sometimes there were fist fights, people pushed out of the car. So the entire period of Jim Crow was being challenged and resisted on a daily basis by blacks in the city. But technically they weren't supposed to adjust the screen. But for the sake of convenience, they might see what had to be done and they'd move the screen, find a place where they could sit. Some of my favorite stories involved the fact that during rush hour, people were crowded together in the aisles, black and white. The phrase one man used was, you know, body pressed against body. But, you know, there was nothing they could do about it. But once people started to empty out, everyone knew that they had to move forward or backward and readjust themselves. So it was like a moving civics lesson in Jim Crow. You learn how to behave in public based on that. I mean, Louis Armstrong wrote about that in his autobiography. It's one of the more famous examples of what that did to people. And of course, it was such a difficult thing to do. The railway companies in New Orleans had fought against this because there were so many dark-complected Italian Americans. Their argument, and it lasted for quite a while, was that race is a judicial concern and that our conductors and motormen, while they're very nice and we're not questioning their intelligence, they are not judges. So that was the tack they had taken. They wouldn't insult their workers, but they suggested this is a judicial matter. Only some of the brightest legal minds in Louisiana should be charged with that decision.
Well, it's amazing how it all comes together. Race, streetcars, and food. Thanks for talking with us, Michael.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
That was Michael Mizell Nelson back in 2010. Sadly, Michael, acclaimed historian and streetcar storyteller, passed away in 2014. But his legacy lives on today with every streetcar ride. Coming up next, we delve into our archives to hear from the late civil rights activist Rudy Lombard. His stage sit-in at a New Orleans lunch counter led to the landmark Supreme Court case that ended segregation in restaurants. Louisiana Eats returns after the break.
American music, infused with Scottish and Irish rhythms, melodies, and ballad forms, travelled full circle to influence singers and guitarists, including Archie Fisher and Bert Jansch, Americana Celts, this week on The Thistle and Shamrock.
Coming up Sunday at 6 p.m. on KRVS.
School's out, we're stuck at home, so let's keep learning together.
One day, we might be able to talk, to communicate with, not just with dolphins, but with animals, like Dr. Doolittle, right?
I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and Guy Raz joins me for a special summer show with big ideas for the entire family. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Coming up tonight at 7 on KRVS.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and from the Ralph Brennan Restaurant Group. The Napoleon House in New Orleans French Quarter is now offering dine-in as well as takeout Tuesday through Saturday, including muffaladas, gumbo, frozen Pimm's cups, and more. They may be reached online at napoleonhouse.com and at 504-524-9752.
Dr. Rudy Lombard was a man of principle who believed in equality. As a civil rights activist in New Orleans, Rudy staged a sit-in at McCrory's lunch counter, an act of civil disobedience that led to the landmark Supreme Court case which ended segregation in restaurants, Lombard versus Louisiana. My friend Rudy Lombard passed away in 2014, but his legacy is immortalized in the fight for racial equality. In this 2011 interview, Rudy discusses his activism, which was spurred by his personal experience as the child of the housekeeper and cook at an uptown residence of prominent New Orleanians. Let's hear Rudy's story in his own voice.
Now, take us back to those days of the lunch counter sit-ins. What propelled you into action?
I think for me, my mother cooked for one of the wealthy families in New Orleans. It was the Stewart, John Stewart family. They lived on the corner of Dryads and Napoleon, across the street from one of the better-known restaurants, Manali's. And when I was a kid, I used to accompany my mother to work. But I was curious as hell about what went on at Manali's. And sort of resolved that one of these days I was going to go in that restaurant. And I knew then as a kid that blacks were not allowed to go. Of course, everybody in my family, including my father, who had gone to cooking school on the GI Bill, knew how to cook. But my mother was so terrific that he wouldn't dare go near the kitchen when she was alive. He worked at the, what they call a Marine Hospital up on Nashville. That was a place that catered to merchant seamen. And he worked the graveyard shift. So he came home in the morning about 7 o'clock, and all of his friends gathered in the kitchen. And, of course, my mother had food for them. Year in and year out, sometimes my mother would cook 3 meals a day before she started working full-time for the various white families as a domestic. So she was a gourmet cook because of the time she spent in the Garden District cooking for John Stewart's family and so forth. In that very wealthy neighborhood, most of the people who did the cooking were blacks. The men were waiters and chauffeurs and so forth and so on. Most of the cooks at that time were women. So I got to see all of these extraordinary people who were cooking in the back of the house, so to speak. And it stayed with me.
So how did you end up at the lunch counter?
Well, I was a longshoreman. I had spent a year at the University of Michigan. I found out that my parents really couldn't afford for me to go there. I didn't have a scholarship. So I had to figure out a way to come back home. Without telling them, I had discovered that the tuition cost more money than they were making. So I told them I wanted to be president of the International Longshoremen's Union here, the black one, because the unions were segregated. And that was my ambition until 1960, when 4 students from North Carolina A&T had a sit-in at the Woolworth's lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina, and that changed everything. And I remember thinking to myself, well, that's never going to happen here because the police were too mean-spirited and they would just, you know, cause a lot of violence and stuff. I wasn't wrong about that. But the Congress of Racial Equality had taken into their employ some of the students who got kicked out of Southern University because they had a demonstration where they simply marched around the Capitol in Baton Rouge.
And even at Southern University, that wasn't allowed.
No, they got expelled. But one of them, a guy named Marvin Robinson, became a staff member, they called them field secretaries at the time, for the Congress of Racial Equality. And to make a long story short, he introduced me to a wonderful man by the name of James T. McCain. Core hired him and sent him to New Orleans, and he came here and helped us organize a local CORE chapter.
That's the acronym for the Congress of Racial Equality. It's CORE.
Right. So we decided that in the coming September mm-hmm. of 1960, we would do a sit-in downtown. The first one we did was at Woolworth on the corner of Canal and Rampart. And the second week, we didn't have but four other students left. I was the spokesman for the first one. And we sat in at the lunch counter at McCrory's. And myself, Aretha Haley, Cecil Carter, and a white student from Tulane by the name of Lanny Goldfinch.
So what happened? What happened when you all went in and took
Well, they asked us to leave, and when we refused, they arrested us. They accused us of criminal trespassing and so forth and so on. And the case went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, and my name got attached to the case that involved the other students and myself. And the ruling was that it was unconstitutional to discriminate against people on the basis of race in a place of public accommodations. The difference in the situation was that the mayor insisted that blacks not be served in those places of public accommodation.
Who was that mayor?
Chet Morrison. And as a result, ultimately the United States Supreme Court said, well, this wasn't an issue of private property, because if the mayor insisted on, you know, that the local codes be enforced, which were not on the books so much, but it was the tradition of not serving blacks and whites in places of public accommodation. The fact that he insisted on us being arrested and being denied service made it a case that took it out of the realm of, say, private property and made it a public action. So his involvement made it such that the court ruled this was not an issue of public accommodation, but state action in effect. There were five cases that were heard at the same time. So it made it possible for blacks and whites to go to the same places, restaurant, hotels, whatever.
So what did your parents think about this?
My parents were very supportive. My father was very, what people might call, you know, politically radical from those days. And my mother, you know, my mother loved her children. So the only concern she had was, you know, about our personal, physical safety. And she would come around to see if I was okay, but she wouldn't say anything. She'd take off from work, check it out, see if I was fine, then she'd go home.
That was Rudy Lombard speaking to us in 2011. The great New Orleans civil rights activist passed away in 2014. In the company of others, many of us may try to avoid politics by instead turning to safer topics like food. But what happens when food becomes political? Historian Jill Cooley's book, To Live and Dine in Dixie, addresses food politics without hesitation. She traces the story of race and gender politics within dining spaces during the age of Jim Crow. We spoke with Jill to learn about how restaurants became so politically charged during the 1960s. Jill began by describing how this research first sparked her interest.
You know, the book started out as my dissertation. I actually started my professional career as a lawyer, and I was really intrigued by this case that I had recalled in law school, Katzenbach versus McClung, and it was a case out of Birmingham, Alabama, which struck me as being a case from back home. The case involved a barbecue restaurant called Ollie's Barbecue in Birmingham. So when I was doing my graduate work, I thought about that case, and I knew I wanted to somehow combine my, you know, legal studies with my history studies and do more of a social cultural history of the law, basically. And this case really just set me on a track of learning about the background of segregation in public eating spaces, and there are so many contradictions involved in that. And the paradox that really struck me when I looked at the Ollie's Barbecue case was the notion that white Southerners didn't want to eat in the same dining room as African Americans, and yet back in the kitchen, it was African Americans who were largely cooking the food and preparing it and serving it to the white diners. You know, having grown up in the South in the generation after the fall of segregation laws, that seemed like such a paradox to me that I wanted to really explore it and try to understand it better. And so that's where the book comes from, just those different facets of my life coming together in a scholarly way.
It is really fascinating. It's a fascinating topic that all these years after the civil rights movement, we all still continue to grapple with. And segregation included all public spaces and public transportation and everything. So to you, the dining spaces were unique and stood out because in white restaurants, there were black people in the kitchen, but we couldn't eat in black restaurants?
Yeah, it did. I mean, that paradox really struck me. And I was very much influenced by Grace Elizabeth Held's book, Making Whiteness. And in that book, she talks about this kind of cultural segregation. She talks about how segregation became an important part of Southerners' lives. It affected kind of the interactions between Southerners in all of these public spaces that you mentioned, transportation. And she talks about the country store a lot. And Hill suggests that maybe there is something sort of special about, you know, the touching of food to lips that makes eating spaces perhaps different or special in this era when all public spaces came to be segregated. And for me, I think there are. I mean, segregation was significant in all aspects of Southern life, but I don't think it's a coincidence that on February 1, 1960, it's lunch counters that students targeted for those initial sit-ins. So I don't think that's a coincidence. I think there was something really pervasive and significant in eating spaces that caused them to receive kind of special attention, at least early on in the civil rights movement.
Well, during this time of turbulent change, Southern women are changing too. And I'd like to hear your thoughts about how those changing roles of Southern women influence both racial politics and the food culture at home and also in public?
You know, that's a great question. And I think you can look at that on two different levels, at home and in public. Women were extremely instrumental in bringing these kind of national food practices to Southern cities. And they did it because they were largely in control of, you know, what they ate and how they ate within their homes. So women of the middle class, you know, they brought home economics practices into Southern cities, including advice for women and how to buy foods in marketplaces. So on the one level, you know, women are active agents of change in food practices. And of course, those food practices at home were segregated because a lot of middle-class white women had black servants. And the black servants were very intimately associated with the food that the white family was eating and consuming. And yet within the home, there were these kind of racialized boundaries where the black servants didn't eat with the white family. So these racial prescriptions that were developing by law in the public sphere were also happening in white homes as well. And then on the other side of it, women are becoming more active participants in public activities like dining. There was a time, and again, this was not just in the South, this was a national ideal, that women wouldn't necessarily go to restaurants or wouldn't necessarily go to lunchrooms, that those were considered to be very male spaces. And even as late as the, you know, early 1960s, I think this was Georgia, the Solicitor General filed a brief against some of the civil rights activists that had been arrested during the sit-ins. And his argument was that the city could kick anybody out of a restaurant that they wanted to. It wasn't just that they were kicking African-American students out, but they could kick people out wearing shorts, or they could kick women out for being in a restaurant. The idea that maybe these were spaces that were too unsafe somehow for women culturally.
What's your number one aha that you learned?
In the South particularly, I noticed kind of two parallel larger historical influences. One was the spread of kind of national eating practices. Okay, so when we think about traditional Southern food, we think about the food mom would spend all morning cooking and then have like big lunches. But in the South, as the 20th century wore on, kind of more industrial, urban food practices began to kind of infiltrate. And that was just the national food market, the cafes, the lunch stands, the fast food spaces. And the second thing that I find was important was just as cities were growing and as suburban areas were emerging in the South, white Southerners are trying to find ways to kind of reestablish white supremacy in kind of these new spaces that are developing that really didn't exist before the Civil War, because the events of the late 19th century, Civil War, emancipation, Reconstruction, really kind of disrupted those kind of traditional modes of white supremacy in the South, namely slavery. And then, of course, black activists, even early in the 20th century, are pushing back against those segregation efforts. And so it's these two kind of parallel tracks that I find come together. And in these kind of new spaces of the lunch counter, of the cafe, you know, establishing rules of etiquette, sometimes they were actual laws that were put in place, but sometimes they were just more cultural practices that would define racial status.
Can you give me an example of one of those practices?
Segregation itself. In the 1960s, white Southerners told themselves that segregation, you know, was very historical, and this is the way it was supposed to be, and this is the way that it always had been. But if you look at, you know, Ollie's Barbecue is a 1964 case, segregation was only 50 years old at that point. Now, that may seem like a long time, but it's not forever.
No.
So even though we like to tell ourselves that there were, you know, really clear racial definitions of who could eat where throughout history up until 1964, that's not necessarily true. It was a little messier than that. And the reason for implementing these laws was to create that clear status differentiation between black and white, so that even the poorest white person would have an elevated status, you know, over the wealthiest black person in the city.
From your point of view, why is the consumption of food so intensely political and polarizing?
I think for me, the answer comes down to power, that access to healthy food is about power politics. You know, who has access to resources in society and who doesn't? And how do you go about getting access to those resources, whether it's, you know, healthy water in Flint, Michigan, or whether it's food in, you know, the Mississippi Delta? You know, how you get access to those resources can reflect, you know, your power within society. And often we find the people who have less power, both in terms of electoral power, but also kind of cultural power, those are the people who, you know, don't have access to those resources. And food obviously is an important resource.
Jill Cooley, author of To Live and Dine in Dixie. Our Louisiana Eats studios are located in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum on the corner of Martin Luther King Jr. and Aretha Castle Haley Boulevards. Who was Aretha Castle Haley, And why was Dryad Street renamed in her honor in the 1980s? Stay tuned, and we'll explore that topic when we come right back.
KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Get yourself a Titas de Café and drop a quarter into La Lu Jukebox with me, your host, Blake Miller. This jukebox plays all the good stuff. Cajun, country, small pop, Cajun music that sounds like small pop that sounds like country, country that sounds like Cajun, Cajun that sounds...
That's La Lu Jukebox with Blake Miller, Saturday night at 6 and Sunday morning at 7, right here on KRVS.
It's old, oh yeah, but it's still relevant. Things change, but not our love of gold. Music gold, for sure. And the vault is full on the Old Gold Show. Classic and time-tested hits.
There you sit, all by yourself.
Take that nostalgic trip with us on Thursdays at noon on 88.7 KRVS. I'm Lee Kleinpeter.
And I thank you.
This week on This American Life.
Like, we wouldn't believe any of this if we weren't here, right?
No.
For 2 months, we've been talking to and recording nurses and doctors at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit as things have slowly moved back to normal with fewer and fewer COVID patients. This is a doctor and nurse manager worried about the nursing staff.
The cumulative stress of caring for these patients when they're not recovering is something we have to be really honest about.
This week.
They're feeling it.
Coming up tonight at 7 on KRVS.
Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Louisiana Fish Fry, breadings, boils, new air fry mixes, and more classic Louisiana dishes available everywhere. Dig into homemade Louisiana flavor. And from the St. Tammany Parish Tourist Commission, located 40 minutes north of New Orleans French Quarter along the shores of Lake Pontchartrain. The North Shore's Tammany Taste features the chefs and farmers, brewers and bakers of St. Tammany Parish's culinary scene. Plan your getaway to discover the many reasons to love Louisiana North Shore at louisiananorthshore.com/10. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Who was Aretha Castle Haley, and why was Dryad Street renamed in her honor in the 1980s? To answer that question, we need to go back in time a couple of hundred years. Central City, which was once known as the Dryad Street Commercial District, was originally laid out by French architect and engineer Barthélemy Lafon in 1809. The first anchor of the neighborhood was the Dryad's Market, established in 1849 as part of the city's public market system. The site of the original Dryad's Market is now home to the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, the place Louisiana Eats calls home. Then, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, Jewish and Italian merchants, African-American doctors and insurance companies, dairymen like Brown's Dairy, and German bakers like Leidenheimer's all set up shop there, taking advantage of the entrepreneurial opportunities available to anyone with the ideas and the energy to become a success. By 1923, the neighborhood was so densely populated with businesses that it was served by 5 streetcar lines. During the Jim Crow era, it became the neighborhood that many black musicians called home. Cultural figures like Dave Bartholomew and Professor Longhair frequented the storied Dewdrop Inn. Central City also gave birth to the modern civil rights movement in New Orleans and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference during the turbulent 1960s. In the late 1980s, the corridor was renamed posthumously for Aretha Castle Haley. She was a civil rights pioneer who, as a young college student, joined the 1960 boycott of stores on Dryad Street that wouldn't hire black sales clerks or cashiers, in spite of the fact that the majority of customers in the shopping district were black. She also sat alongside Rudy Lombard in the McCrory's lunch counter sit-in on Canal Street, which helped end segregation in restaurants. Mrs. Haley was the president of the New Orleans chapter of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, and dedicated her life to social justice issues, including education and health care. Now, here's a little-known fact about Mrs. Haley. Her mother was Virgie Castle, who ran Leah Chase's bar at Dookie Chase Restaurant for years, proving that once again, in New Orleans, we all have barely one degree of separation. I'm Poppy Tooker, and we're proud to call Aretha Castle Haley Boulevard our Louisiana Eats home.
My name is John T. Edge, and I wrote a book. It's called The Potlicker Papers, A Food History of the Modern South.
With his boundless knowledge of Southern culture, historian and writer John T. Edge is a go-to authority on the topic of food and race in the South. In his definitive work, The Potlicker Papers, John T. tracks the history of Southern food, delving into issues of race, class, gender, and ethnicity from the civil rights era through today. While digesting the Potlicker Papers, I had the sense that I was reading a history book designed to teach future generations just how we came to where we are today. When John T. joined us in our studio back in 2017, I asked if he felt he was writing for the benefit of tomorrow's readers.
I mean, that's, you know, for me to say that, I'd sound hubristic to say that. So I'll say this. I recognize the South began to change in 1955 with the Montgomery bus boycotts, with the beginning of the civil rights movement. And I realized that that perspective on food, that maybe I would be one of the few people that might start a book that way and might see the changes in the South beginning with 55. And I take pride in that kind of construction and the kind of catalytic beginnings of the book rooted in the movement. So if that holds on for posterity and people begin to think about a changing South through food in 55, I'm happy about that.
What is potlicker, and why did you call your book The Potlicker Papers?
Potlicker is the distilled essence of a pot of greens or a pot of beans, cooked often with pork. After you've eaten the greens, it's the watery residue at the bottom of that pot. And, you know, one of the great and profound ironies of that is that the liquor is where the nutrients reside. And in the days of enslavement, oftentimes enslaved masters would keep the greens and deign to give the liquor to the enslaved, not knowing that that's where the true nutrients resided. So there's a subversive beauty in that, and it's one of the reasons I chose that title. That metaphor, though, for the distilled essence serves me too, because I'm trying to make sense of 60 years of Southern history in this book, and how do I get to the core? How do I get to that boil-down essence?
You taught me many things in this book and introduced me to a lot of people I had never met before. I was particularly happy to have a seat at Georgia Gilmore's mm-hmm. kitchen table. Tell us about her kitchen table and what Georgia accomplished there.
Georgia Gilmore opens the book in 1955. And when Rosa Parks famously refuses to step to the back of the bus in 1955 in Montgomery, Alabama, and when Dr. King, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and his colleagues form the Montgomery Improvement Association. At that first mass meeting where Black Montgomery comes together to plan resistance, to plan protest, to plan an alternate transportation system. They're going to quit the buses of Montgomery and build their own alternate transportation system. Georgia Gilmore, a cook, a midwife, a woman who had literally laid track on the railroad, raised six children, put them through Catholic schools in Montgomery. Georgia Gilmore is there at that very first mass meeting, and she brings a hamper of fried chicken and white bread, chicken sandwiches. And she is intent upon selling those sandwiches to raise money for the bus boycotts. Because if you're going to start an alternate transportation system, if you're going to use station wagons from churches and you're going to use family sedans to drive the maids and cooks, the Black maids and cooks of Montgomery around town to their jobs, you're going to need gas for the cars. Eventually, you're going to need new brakes. You're going to need insurance policies. All these things are needed to drive this protest movement, and the beginnings of that protest movement are fueled by Black cooks, Black maids, Black women like Georgia Gilmore.
All at their kitchen table. And fascinatingly to me, what started with a fried chicken sandwich on white bread turned into quite an enterprise, because this was something happening across the segregated South where kitchen tables also suddenly became impromptu restaurants.
Yeah. The idea is you, a working class cook, have learned over years of cooking for a wealthier family and cooking for your own family. You've learned skills, and you leverage those skills, and you cook for your neighbors. You cook for your friends. You cook for the people with whom you go to church. And your dining room table is slowly transformed into a quasi-restaurant. And that's what Georgia Gilmore did in the years after the bus boycotts, after the success of the bus boycotts. She ends up turning her home dining room table into a restaurant table where King and Kennedy, where the civil rights movement coalesced and plotted strategies. And people like King wanted fried pork chops for lunch. They wanted the foods of their youth. They wanted comfort in a time of strife, and they found it at her table.
I was very surprised to find huge bits of the Potlicker Papers addressing a lot of white Southerners as well. I didn't really expect to find Colonel Sanders and Paula Deen in your book.
Right. Well, you know, I wrote a book, I hope, that's not a celebration of the South, but is a clear-eyed look at the South. Ultimately, I see this as a triumphant place, a place of hope. But if you're going to write about the South, you need to face down the ills of this place as well. This book begins in 1955 with the Montgomery bus boycotts, and the divides between the good guys and the bad guys are pretty stark. We know today who was fighting on the wrong side of history then. Paula Deen, with her racial slurs in 2015, that moment, which happens almost simultaneously with Dylann Roof's terrorist act in the Charleston church, reminds us that the South is still a broken place, reminds us that this woman who rose to fame underemploying Dora Charles, who wrote a fabulous book after the fact about what she learned in her mother's and grandmother's kitchen and how she leveraged that for Paula Deen's fame. Paula Deen reminds us that the debts of pleasure that we owe to African-American Southerners, to working-class white Southerners, and now will soon owe to immigrants who are massing here in the South, we've not paid them down. We haven't reconciled. We are not a redeemed place. And Paula Deen makes that case unwittingly and in a way that riles me still. You can probably hear it in my voice. She distracted the world with this kind of sausage gravy, butter sobbed that just me off hell to hell and back.
That's kind of rankles me too, John. John, you refer to what you call the new hybridized South, and I'd like to hear from you how you see the Black and white ownership of the South today.
I think too often still when we say the South, whether that's what you intend when you say it, or when you say Southerner, whether that's what you intend when you say it, oftentimes what people hear is the White South. And they frame that South by way of the failed gambit of the Confederacy. You know, they talk about North-South polarities, about the Yankees and the Southerners, and that's just not a useful frame in this moment. You know, this place has evolved over the last 60 years in ways that are crazily dynamic. We think about the South somehow as this bunker of tradition. But if you look openly and clearly at this region, you see, especially in a city like New Orleans, you see the effect post-Katrina of Central American and Mexican-American peoples who helped rebuild the city in the same way that Mexican-American peoples built the skyscrapers of Charlotte and remained in Charlotte to reinvent the foodways of a city like Charlotte, North Carolina. You see a future tense South that will be black and white and brown and will welcome a wide variety of people from a wide variety of places. And one of the best ways to apprehend that future is by regarding our food culture. One of the ways to apprehend that is by taking a seat and eating a banh mi sandwich while you look over to the right and there's somebody munching down on a fried oyster po' boy. Both those sandwiches are French Creolized expressions of this place we call home and beautifully rendered in this moment.
Looking into the bottom of the pot, if you were to gaze at the pot liquor of the New South and the future, what do you see there?
There's a pot of chili d'arbol bobbing in there. The greens might be flavored with fish sauce. I actually cook my greens that way a lot now. In that pot, I taste those flavors, and I see a brighter future for the South for those additions. I don't see anything lost. This is not a zero-sum game, people. You know, cultures evolve. Culture is a process, not a product, and the process inspires me.
John T. Edge, director of the Southern Foodways Alliance and author of the Potlicker Papers. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Catch up on previous editions of Louisiana Eats on poppytooker.com, where we have 10 years of Louisiana Eats editions available for pod and webcasting, along with recipes and videos, too. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Louisiana Fish Fry, Camellia Brand Beans, and the St. Tammany Parish Tourist Commission. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Acorn, now reopened in City Park. Located at the Louisiana Children's Museum, Acorn is open every day from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. Coffee, breakfast, lunch, and snacks served up with some of the best views in the city. Takeout and picnics to go are available. Museum admission not required. Original theme music composed by David Palmer Lowe and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner and special projects manager Reggie Morris. And to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Catch up with us anytime on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.